And we're back. Thank you so much for coming back and listening to Blue Cirrus Telehealth Radio. As I said earlier, I'm Michelle Hager. I'm the managing partner of Blue Cirrus. And tonight we have our third guest, which is Mei Kwong, the executive director of the Center for Connected Health Policy. Ms. Kwong is a nationally recognized expert on telehealth policy. In her current role at CCHP, she works with the organization's multitude of national and regional partners on telehealth issues and oversees CCHP's projects, provides policy technical assistance to state and federal lawmakers, industry members, providers, consumers, and others. And what we didn't say is that you are, in fact, an attorney. So welcome, Mei. Thanks so much for being on the show tonight.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are always policy junkies on this show. So we talked a little bit with Lloyd and with Jonathan around some of the changes that are happening in the DEA, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But I want to make sure that as we inform our listeners, as we talk every month about healthcare and telehealth issues, tell us a little bit about and our listeners about CCHP and how CCHP, the Connected Center for Connected Health Policy, how it started and its origins.
Well, actually, CCHP started as a California telehealth policy organization back in 2009. We were mainly focused on what was going on the state level, but an opportunity to become the federally designated National Telehealth Policy Resource Center became available through funding from HRSA in 2012. We applied for that and we got in. We've been serving in that capacity ever since. You talked a little bit about like what we do. We provide technical assistance. Primarily, we're supposed to provide technical assistance to the other telehealth resource centers who are underneath the same funding stream. These are the regional telehealth resource centers that cover specific states. So the theory was that when they ran into policy questions that maybe they couldn't answer, they would elevate it to the national center, which is CCHP. However, when we received the funding, kind of the parameters of what we were supposed to do were a little bit vague. So we really just worked out a plan of like, well, we think this is probably what the telehealth community needs. So we kind of structured it that way. And I think it's may have gone a direction that the federal government wasn't like quite expecting. In particular, one thing that we're known for and one thing that we created right out of the gate. Basically, we received our funding September 1st, 2012, and then we launched in January 2013 our 50-state policy finder. So for those who are not familiar with that, that is where we track all the state Medicaid policies, laws, and regulations related to telehealth. We put it up in a navigable, like, interactive map on our website, where if you're interested in a particular state, you can just click on that and the information that we found pops up for it. And that was actually the first time that that had ever really been done that way. We had found historically there had been some attempt to like sort of compile all of the state policies around telehealth, at least for Medicaid, but not necessarily laws and regulations, but it wasn't kept updated. So we thought that was probably a significant need for the telehealth community, and we did that as one of our first things when we became the national center. And we've kept that up to date. It's funny. We just, launched our sort of spring update for that information. We released it this morning. So
Oh, did you?
we did, yeah. So we got the grant in 2012, and this is 2023. So we've been updating and tracking all that for 11 years at this point. So we've
Wow.
definitely seen the changes that have happened in this country related to telehealth policy.
How often do you update it? Is it twice a year?
So it's varied over the years. And part of the reason has become the policy itself has become more voluminous and
Yeah.
complicated over the
Dynamic
years.
is the word I use. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to give you an idea, when we were doing sort of not quite print editions, but they were PDFs. So they were compiled like in one file type of editions. When we first started, they were like about 200 pages and went, whoa, this is large. It's 200 pages. And the last time we did that, which was a couple of years ago, it was like close to 600 pages at that point.
Wow.
So that can tell you like the changes that have happened and the increase in policy. But as far as like how often we update it, we actually have gotten into the habit of updating it continuously. Now, by that, I mean, we don't do all, well, right now it's 54 jurisdictions. So it's 50 states, the District of Columbia, the federal government, and then also Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. Mm-hmm. We don't do that all at once. We do a continuous update. So we try to update like maybe two or three jurisdictions a week. And folks who are familiar with it, the reason it, you may think like, well, that's kind of slow. It is because it is very difficult to do this. It is really hand done. It's like done individually by a staff person who has to check that policy, who has to check that link, et cetera, et cetera. There's no, when asked like, isn't there like a common database, like a LexisNexis that kind of like brings it all up, like not for this. So we have to do that by hand, which is why it takes so long. So it's continuously updated. But then we do like a summation of sort of like we look at a period in time from this last update is from January to March of 2023 and do a summation of that. We have been doing that twice a year. Starting next year, we're actually going to go to once a year, mainly because we've noticed the spring update usually doesn't have a lot. And that has to do with like a lot of legislation on the state level hasn't passed yet. So there hasn't been as many shifts. But also it's become more and more difficult with the limited amount of resources we have to continue that pace of like the continuous updates.
Right. I agree. It is very tedious work. It's actually something that Blue Sierras does as well. We don't do the 50 state survey that you do, which is excellent resource. And we always refer our customers as well to the CCHP website, which, by the way, I should let everybody know that if you want to access any of the Connected Health Policy website information, it's CCHPCA, hence your California connection, CCHPCA.org. And you can access this interactive map, which is really excellent that you mentioned. And I should say, I'm not sure if I'm going to catch all the topics, but it includes licensure, it includes Medicaid reimbursement, and also some scope of practice law, if I recall, per state. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's true. And also there's a special section now. We received funding from the National Association of Community Health Centers, NAC, to do a special FQHC section, Federally Qualified Health Center section, for state Medicaid as well, too. So there's that. You'll also notice if you go there now, there's a COVID section that probably will be retired soon. Okay. It was necessary to the last 3 years, but actually quite a few states have already settled in their post-COVID type of policies for telehealth.
So good segue. It was a question that I had for you around the end of the public health emergency. And what are the current trends around telehealth policy, given that we have seen the PHE ending, a lot of folks in health systems and FQHCs, those federally qualified health centers, rural health centers, they have some concern that maybe this means the end of telehealth now that the PHE has ended. Tell us a little bit about your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, in general, if you're talking about trends in general, reimbursement and coverage, that's always going to be a significant policy issue to be discussed. And when you look at that, you're also going to have to look at it through multiple lenses, because there's what goes on the federal level, which is Medicare, but then there's also what goes on the state level, which is Medicaid. Yes. So on the federal, and then there's private payers, like that's what commercial payers do too. And that's actually a little bit more state controlled rather than federal controlled. So you have these different layers as far as like, you know, who's going to be controlling the policy on that. So the public health emergency ended last week. That was the federal one. So it in Medicare, it extended coverage, the grace period for some of the relaxations that were done during the federal public health emergency. It basically extended a lot of those policies through 2024. Some of them are only extended through 2023, and some of them went away when the public health emergency ended. But some of the major coverage and reimbursement ones were extended through 2024. So there's a temporary reprieve, a grace period that in the Medicare program where you can still get your telehealth services covered and those practitioners will be paid. But then if you go, are your patients covered by Medicaid, or if you're covered by Medicaid, that's going to vary from state to state. And as I said earlier, a lot of states have actually already decided what they're doing. So So the end of the federal public health emergency didn't necessarily impact a lot of what states were doing. And then for commercial payers, that's a whole other story. A lot of states have laws mandating what commercial payers are supposed to do around telehealth. And some of them are a bit more specific than others. So that's also going to vary a lot too.
I think we also saw there may have even been just one state that still had the public health emergency happening, or maybe they had all, for a long time, all the states had, as you said, finished their public health emergencies. So the individual state law that was already closing down, but we do see individual states now trying to do some evaluation around how should we pay for telehealth? What is it that we should pay and at what level? And we've talked a lot on this show about parity of payment versus payment parity, or just parity in general, you know, whether or not you get the exact same amount as whether or not you are in person or whether you just have to pay for it in general. And that varies by state, which telehealth is, as we've talked about before, is a very disruptive technology in terms of the operations and disruptive in a good way. And that means that it's hard for sometimes legislators to get their arms around it. So we do see some states making some changes and trying to look at their individual state policies and how they should move forward with it. But when you think about all the changes that have happened recently, particularly related to, and we talked a little bit about this with Jonathan Neufeld around the DEA proposed rules. And since we had that interview with Jonathan, we've actually seen that we now have a new update from the DEA, hence these changes always causing challenges for all of us and also for patients. Talk about that proposed rule and the current standing of the DEA and how that impacts individual patients and their families.
Yeah, that's like the other sort of big policy trend or question that's out there that is, you know, the DEA and what they've done with prescribing controlled substance. So I'm just going to pause there to make sure everybody understands this. What the DEA did in relation to telehealth and prescribing, it is about controlled substances. Yeah. So non-controlled substances, that for the most part is underneath states on what, how they approach it and, you know, how telehealth can be used for it. So that's also like a split that you see there when you're talking about prescribing in general. Controlled substances, it's federal, but non-controlled substances, it's states. But as far as what the DEA did, for those audience members who are not familiar with it, during the public health emergency, there was an exception made in using telehealth when you prescribe a controlled substance. And that is, this was actually an exception in federal law, and it's been in there for years. So Congress did not do anything in response to COVID-19. This just automatically kicked in. And what federal law says about telehealth when you prescribe a controlled substance is, there are a couple exceptions where we allow telehealth to be used if that telehealth provider who's prescribing has not had an in-person examination of the patient. And these exceptions are very narrow and very specific. And they're things like when the patient's with another DEA registered practitioner during the time of the telehealth interaction, or when they're in a DEA licensed facility during the telehealth interaction. One of those exceptions was when a public health emergency is declared. COVID was declared, the exception kicked in. So during the last 3 years of the pandemic, telehealth providers were able to prescribe without having seen their patient in person because of this exception. However, when the public health emergency ends, that automatically goes away. That is the federal law. Congress didn't do anything to like change it, nor did they do anything to like implement anything. Again, it was in federal law before the pandemic. It just kicked in. So to address what would happen during that, because there was a lot of concerns of people were receiving a lot of services and their prescriptions that way, and a lot of them could be had a catastrophic incidences if it's suddenly just cut off. And these were people who were, you know, perhaps receiving medication to treat mental or behavioral health issues, or perhaps they were, you know, other types of treatments for other conditions as well. There was that concern. And the DEA, I think for probably a majority of folks who are monitoring this issue, we really thought they were going to do, we knew that they were going to do something, We thought they were going to finally do one of the other exceptions that's in law, and that was to create a registry. So one of the other sort of narrow exceptions that exists in federal law was the creation of a registry, which theoretically you're a practitioner, you get on the registry, you're good egg, good actor, you've been vetted and everything. You can go ahead and prescribe. You don't have to see the patient in person. That registry has never been created. Congress told DEA to create that registry in 2019. It still has not been created.
And so again, they like reinforced that a couple of times. Do it.
I know. I believe it was Senator Warner who actually asked him like 2 years ago, sent a letter during the pandemic, said, by the way, where's the registry? So we just all assumed like, oh, they're going to do the registry. That's going to be their solution to this. That was not the solution. Their solution was to create yet another narrow exception to what you can do to prescribe. And I called it the asynchronous option, which was you basically, it required the patient, basically the other options were still open. You can still see the patient in person. You met your obligation, et cetera. And then they said, but we're also going to give you this other option. And this other option was first off, we'll give you like a half step, a kind of grace period. Like you could supply a 30-day supply of medication of non-narcotic controlled substance.
Right.
So that's even different. That's even narrower. You couldn't prescribe a narcotic controlled substance. It was, you can prescribe a 30-day supply of non-narcotic controlled substances. But after that, you got to meet this in-person requirement in some ways. And then we're going to give you like another option out of like, you know, besides those other five really narrow ones and seeing somebody in person. And that option was, well, if they go in with a DEA registered practitioner and like they take all their history and everything, and that DEA practitioner forwards all that to you, telehealth provider, that's fine then. And then they did two rules. So that was the first one. And the second rule was they said like, we'll allow that also to happen if you're prescribing buprenorphine for a substance use disorder. And the reason they had to do that was because in the other rule, they said non-narcotic, buprenorphine is a narcotic. So they had to do that exception in a different rule. And then they also said like, and we're going to give you a 180-day grace period for those who established those patient-provider relationships during the pandemic, and you hadn't done like an in-person thing yet.
Right.
To give you 180 days to do the in-person thing. Hyper-specific, very narrow, did not go over well with a lot of people.
No. So
I understand they received almost 39,000 comments regarding.
That's what I heard too.
Polls. Yeah. So all that led to, Michelle, what you're referring to their next sort of step, which was, all right, we're going to put a pause. We're going to put a pause on this. And what we're going to allow is, basically what you could have done, you could do during the public health emergency, during the COVID public health emergency for prescribing controlled substances. We're going to allow that to continue for an additional 6 months until November 11, 2023. So they extended that, they gave practitioners and everybody a grace period of 6 months to continue to prescribe with that, you know, basically through telehealth without having that in-person visit. And then they said, starting November 12, 2023 through November 11, 2024, if you've established that relationship during COVID or during that 6 months grace period, we'll allow you to continue to do that to give you a year to meet that in-person obligation until November 11, 2024. Right. So it's people have to be very clear on that. It's not like a 18-month grace period. It's like grace period of 6 months. And then for those who've done it during that period and during COVID, you're allowed to continue for another year.
Right. I think you're they recognized it was going to be very, very difficult for people to do an in-person visit. I think that was the majority of these complaints where I can't possibly fit an in-person visit for all of these. And I don't even have in-person locations in where people are.
Yeah, there were a lot of concerns. They're like 180 days for us to meet that in-person visit is not going to be enough time for us to do that. So they gave like basically a year for that. Now, what's going to happen in the meantime? Those dates are very curious to me because for those who follow this kind of stuff, November is also kind of the time where Medicare finalizes their physician fee schedule, for CMS finalizes the physician fee schedule for Medicare. And for those who are not familiar with that, the physician fee schedule is something that Medicare puts out every year. It's basically their new policies for Medicare for the following year. Typically, it comes out like in July. So the policies for 2024 they want to implement will come out in July. The draft of it, the proposed one, comes out around July of 2023. You've got like, you know, a certain amount of time to like have public comments. CMS goes back, reads all those public comments, write their responses, and they publish what they call their final rule, typically in November of that same year. Sometimes it's been as late as December, but it's typically like November. And theoretically, unless there's like a specific date attached, with those policies go into effect January 1st of the following year. So for the DEA to line up saying like, we're giving you a grace period to November 11th, 2023, that 6 month grace period, the first date, that's important to know. And then like another year after that, November 2024, that means at some point in that period, they're going to finalize something. Is it going to be what we saw earlier this year, those proposals?
Hopefully not.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But I'm at this point, I'm still holding out hope that maybe they'll do the registry at this point. The thing is with the registry, you'll hear a lot of people talking about it. That's the concept of it. They could still make it kind of onerous to get on that registry too. So that's also something to keep in mind.
I agree with that. And I also heard that the DEA has been in some event talking or whatever and front of Congress and said, we don't think now with COVID that that's relevant to do a registry. So my concern is that they've sort of taken it off the table as even an option. So we'll have to see what will happen.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. To say, you know, my track record predicting what they'll do is like bad. It's probably an understatement. I was like, you know, I did not think that they were going to do an asynchronous option here how to address this after the end of the PHE. So
I think it's really important for people to understand too that, and I want to give the DEA a little bit of grace here, just a skosh, because the DEA is an enforcement agency. They're not a healthcare agency, right? They're not HHS. So they're all about identifying where drugs and diversion could happen and abuse and fraud around, you know, drug use. That's their whole purpose. I think what they recognized was the healthcare industry is a pretty loud industry with almost 39,000 comments and said, hold on a minute, you're going to really mess up healthcare here. And so they did do this backpedaling a little bit to kind of, but I agree with you. This is my prediction is around this being within the physician fee schedule. I think that's sort of where everything is headed. Like, let's just let it cycle. Let's let all of telehealth now cycle into the physician fee schedule as it would have normally been. But we'll get a preview in July of what it might be.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it'll be in the physician fee schedule. I think the timing seems to be aligning up with that. But also, or maybe it could just be like where the federal agencies that maybe have like some say over these telehealth policies are just trying to align what they're doing just to get their timing right. And one other thing is like, I agree with you in that I don't think the DEA's concerns are unwarranted or have no foundation. I mean, but it's just sort of like with all policy, there's a balance that needs to like happen. And I actually don't know if they were involved in helping or providing feedback in those initial draft rules that were released earlier this year by DEA, but I was happy to see that SAMHSA is involved now. At least they mentioned that when they did their press release saying that they were doing this grace period extension. I think that would be helpful for them in getting some of that information from SAMHSA, like, you know, how this plays into like practitioners like utilizing these policies to like treat their patients.
Absolutely. And we've talked before, and even on this show with Lloyd and with Jonathan around you know, the challenges that you mentioned it around controlled substances. So these are schedule 2 through 5 drugs, and well, really schedule 1 through 5, but 1 is non-medicinal. But those 2 through 5 drugs. These include ADHD medications, testosterone treatments, things that people are getting on a regular basis that are really necessary for their children or themselves or other, you know, obviously not just related to pain. I think people think if it's a narcotic, then it's always pain meds. And this is what, this is beyond that. There's a lot of controlled substances that are not necessarily related to pain. But we do know that, you know, the flexibilities, as you mentioned, around, you know, opioid use disorder and some of the drug rules around that, that some of these senators want those flexibilities to remain permanent for lots of different reasons. And then I think it would be helpful to maybe understand a little bit about why this even matters. There's the Ryan Haidt Act and what that means and where the origins of that came from. Can you speak a little bit about that and how these how the Ryan Haidt Act has affected that and why these senators want these flexibilities around opioid use disorder?
So Ryan Haidt Act, again, for those who are not familiar to it, this is like kind of the shorthand that a lot of telehealth folks use. The Ryan Haidt Act was a piece of federal legislation that included those telehealth exceptions in federal laws when you're prescribing controlled substances. So that's why when you talk to telehealth people, they may say, and they're talking about prescribing, they say, oh, the Ryan Haidt Act or Ryan Haidt. That was, and actually that's a little bit before my time when that all happened, but the history of that is that there was a teen named Ryan Haidt who over the internet managed to get some controlled substances prescribed to him just via the internet. And, you know, and very sadly and unfortunately, he passed away. So this really sparked this legislation to create these parameters and how you can use online or the internet to like get a prescription, which, you know, is one thing that you see a lot happen in policy when something very tragic or terrible happens. There's usually like this reaction to create a policy around it. And sometimes it might be, you know, very restrictive. So that's like kind of the basis of like how this happened with telehealth. And for years, telehealth has still continued to like operate underneath it, mainly because telehealth was not widely used over the years until basically the pandemic like threw that open and changed that, and more people were using it, and more people, you know, as Michelle went over, we're not just talking about people with an opioid use disorder or maybe a mental and behavioral health issue. We're talking about people who may need these prescriptions for other reasons. One thing that came to mind, Michelle, when you're talking about it, I was thinking like, I believe some cancer patients need controlled substances as well too. So again, it's not like about, oh, people are doing this to abuse painkillers. It's like, there's actually some medications that are controlled substances people need to use. And it's not about pain control. It's about treatment. So that's sort of like the history of that and why it's been like kind of like a concern. I mean, it's a legitimate concern that I think the DEA has of like, you know, that there could just suddenly be an abuse of this. But again, I go back to, you know, there needs to be sort of a balance there in that you're not tying the hands of like those good actors who are trying to treat their patients and patients who need these services who may not be able to get them any other way or are find it very difficult. And I'm thinking like not only of people in rural areas that maybe have like limited access to certain healthcare services, but also people in urban areas as well who may also have that same issue. So that I think that's the concern that's being raised and being recognized by policymakers now is we understand we don't want anybody to abuse this. We don't want, obviously, we don't want anybody to get hurt or die from this. But how do we strike that balance of like those patients who still need these services can still get it, and we don't run the risk of like depriving them of that. Mm-hmm. And that's the concern of practitioners as well. It's like we want to be able to treat our patients here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Care of the patients and access to care is the primary concern. And with those patients that have opioid use disorder, the biggest challenge is they come into the emergency room, they're you know, addicted. Everyone can, you know, obviously diagnose that. They can see that. They know what the treatment is. But there are only certain certified clinicians that are able to provide these certain drugs out based on the DEA requirements of those certain drug treatments, like you mentioned, then norepinephrine and buprenorphine, I think, is the other one. And neither one of us are clinicians, so we're muddling along. So I apologize for clinicians that might be out there thinking, what the heck are they talking about? But I think it's so important that, you know, you may not, that patient may not be in a location where some of these certified clinicians are. And so therefore they have to do this via telehealth. It's really important. Otherwise they'll be right back out from the emergency room. And as we know, right back to whatever drug they were using. We've said it before, this is the smartest show on radio, May, and you did not disappoint. This is a great discussion on policy and telehealth and overall how CCHP works. As I mentioned before, please make sure to follow and take a look at the CCHP website for more information. There's just chock full of nuts there. CCHPCA.org. Lots for you to access. I really appreciate you taking the time today to talk to us and provide our listeners with helpful information around telehealth and healthcare. I really appreciate you educating us on the purpose and the usage and helpfulness of CCHP, the Connected Health Policy Organization. And thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We'll have you again for sure in the future and come back maybe when the physician fee schedule is back and see if our predictions are correct.
That would be an interesting show.
Yeah, that'll be, we'll talk about predictions and whether we were right or not. Thank you to everybody for listening to tonight's show. As I said, this is Blue Sears Radio. We are the smartest show on radio. And thank you and have a good night.